Hello, and thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. When you're finished with this one, you can help yourself to more than 1,000 other podcasts, all free, on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or through iTunes.
How's that?
I think
one day I feel so.
Well, look, thank you.
Now, what would be my story if that was the case?
Oh, no, so, that's not what I meant.
You can, but I can't answer it.
And there was this indescribable welter of emotions.
I think
to this day,
I will never accept
it. It was
that.
Like something that
never
just sort of snapped in my head.
And look, I don't know, it's a miracle.
And I hope that the people listening to us will enjoy what they hear.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
One of the most confusing things in the world to men, is how an intelligent woman can fall for a dangerous bad boy. These guys range from the charismatic rogue to the violent and cunning psychopath that enjoys dismantling the personality of the woman in his life. Kay Schuback is here today. Kay had a job in Sydney working with A-list celebrities. She was in a settled relationship which, to her, had become stale and unsatisfactory. Then she met a good-looking and dangerously charming man called Simon. Simon seemed to know exactly what Kay wanted, and he offered it to her. Kay Schuback's story is told in her book, which is called Perfect Stranger. Hello, Kay.
Hi.
Let's start with the first meeting in the Sydney restaurant. When did you first notice Simon?
Well, it was one of those moments where the air changes, the molecules in the restaurant just changed. I was sitting having lunch with my friend, oblivious to everything else, munching away on dumplings, and the door open, leaves scuttered in. And this fellow, good-looking man, came and he sat down next to us, a little bit too close. We were the only people in the restaurant. And a little bit in our, you know,
personal space.
And couldn't help but notice him. He knew we were looking, and he listened to everything that we were saying. And I didn't really know at the time, but he was gaining information, hearing what I was saying to my friend and just gaining little tidbits about me, and then joined the conversation. And when he got up to leave, he handed a card with his number on it and asked me to have coffee with him.
What impressed you about him, apart from his you know, male model good looks?
Well, there is something about these kinds of guys. Every now and then you meet one and it's like they've got this rock star aura. You really do notice when they walk in the room. People turn around and look. I noticed it the whole time I was with him. Whenever we walked into a restaurant or a pub or a cafe, everyone would stop and look at him. I don't know what it is. There's something about the atoms in the air that changed. He had a lot of power.
Yeah, well, because, you know, normally when someone does that, sits too close to you, invades your personal space when you're trying to have a nice lunch with your friends and then puts down his car, that'd be kind of annoying normally, wouldn't it? So why wasn't it annoying?
Well, partly because he was incredibly good looking, and he also insinuated himself into our conversation as well. So he created rapport straight away, and he broke down the boundaries straight away. And he made us feel comfortable. He handed over his sunglasses to my friend Todd and, you know, flattered him about how he looked and asked me a couple of questions. You know, he seemed really interested in us.
Did your friend Todd like him as well at that moment?
Well, we kind of were laughing nervously a bit, and it wasn't until Simon walked out and Todd said, "Seems a bit dodgy to me, that bloke. I think he might be a coke dealer." And he said, "Give me his card." And I said, "No, I'm keeping the card. Go away."
At the time, though, you were in a relationship with a guy called Rob. How long had you and Rob been together?
We'd been together for 4 years, and it had been, for me, from 36 to 40. So they were really critical years for me.
Your story here is, it's a little bit like one of those classic Sydney eastern suburbs stories in many ways. And you'd been living that life, hadn't you, in the eastern suburbs of Sydney? Quite a glam life.
I kind of didn't think so at the time, but when I look back and when I did write about it, you know, I had celebrity clients. I had worked for Tom and Nicole. I was working for a music manager at the time. My partner was working for Baz Luhrmann. We did go to some fabulous parties and we did drink champagne. And
great apartment.
Yep, really lovely apartment right in the boiling heart of Darlinghurst. So there was just action and people and, you know, we'd go to the beach at Tamarama and everyone's beautiful. It was Sydney, you know, Sydney's great.
So what took the shine off your relationship with Rob?
It was a war of attrition, really. He was a lovely guy. But he was very slow to move, and I found that I was the dynamic in the relationship. Editing work as a film editor is really hard to come by. It's either a feast or a famine. A lot of the time with him it was a famine. So I was working to pay the mortgage or the rent. I was making the decisions about everywhere we went. And I also wanted to start a family.
You wanted to have a baby?
I wanted to have a baby.
Did he?
No, but he kind of really never told me that he didn't. I kept asking him and I told him that it was important. The first 2 years of the relationship, we kind of muddled along without addressing that too pointedly. And then after those first 2 years, I said, come on, like I'm 38 now, tick, 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 tick.
Did you say tick, 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 tick?
I think you could hear it ticking. But it really, it was hard to take it seriously. I don't think you realise that the biological clock is ticking as loudly as it is, but it was driving me to push him. And so whenever we kind of have that serious conversation that every couple has kind of once a month or so, it would come around to that.
But was he saying one day or was he saying no?
Oh, he kind of just became increasingly more silent about it, just actually refused to acknowledge the situation at all. He didn't say no. If he had have said no, it would have been easier. I would have then been able to make a decision to stay with him. But he didn't ever kind of say anything. He sat on the fence.
So there you are sitting in that Sydney restaurant that day, and this is the state of your relationship. You're starting to get a little worried. How old were you at that point, if you don't mind me asking? Pam, my producer, normally wouldn't let me ask you that question. But it's kind of relevant to the story here, isn't it?
It is relevant. I had just turned 40. So a very sprightly young 40.
That's right, a very charming and well-dressed and attractive 40, indeed. So after having left you his number and walking out of the restaurant, who made the first contact? Was it you?
Yes, I hate to say it was. I went back home and I'd been working from home and I was trying to get a new business up. So I had had quite a lot of time on my own and a lot of time with my thoughts. You know, I just played with this card and I looked at it and I allowed myself to indulge in the fantasy of another man. And I thought, oh, it won't hurt. I'll send him an SMS, you know, and just say perhaps we can meet for that coffee that you suggested. I thought I'd keep it low-key. And I sent him an SMS. My heart was beating like mad because I knew that I was doing something that was naughty and that could lead to possibly, I didn't know where it was going to go, but I didn't allow myself to kind of the first chink of being unfaithful.
Then you had a phone conversation. And what kind of questions did he ask you during that phone conversation with Simon?
You know, straight away I was uncomfortable, but it was like I was on some truth serum. He had this way, I think he was driving in the car, and he just asked really pointed questions about me and my feelings and my personal life straight away. And I was compelled to answer. So he said, so who do you live with? What do you do? Where's your partner now?
These are all short questions. Short questions get more truthful answers, actually. It's a good thing.
Yeah.
You tend to blurt out the truth, don't you? So you told him, well, where's your partner now? And where did the conversation go from there?
Well, he quickly gleaned that I was kind of carrying the financial load. He asked me if I had any kids, and I said, no, I really want them. So straight away, I'd given him quite a lot of information right then and there.
And what did he say when you said you'd wanted kids?
He said, so do I. So straight away, he was in. He had hooked into a very vulnerable part of me. He quickly painted a very idealistic painting of himself. So even in that conversation, he said that he was heading up to Gosford, that he was renovating a house on the bay, that he was going to have a glass of Chardonnay and some prawns on the jetty, and would I like to join him?
What did he tell you about himself? Did you have the presence of mind to ask him, pepper him with questions about himself?
Well, no, I've always been a person who tries to glean information rather than asking outright. I was a little bit shy like that. I wish I had of, in retrospect. But he never gave me the opportunity. He was really barreling questions at me.
And I suppose that's flattering too, isn't it?
He seemed genuinely interested in me, and I hadn't had that for a while.
When you met Simon, for that first lunch. What sort of promises did he make?
Well, I was quite nervous to see him, and when we did meet, it was in a gorgeous bar, and there were all these bartenders kind of twittering around him. It seemed like he had the attention of all the women in the bar and in the restaurant behind. I could feel the eyes on us. We had a glass of wine. He had this I was instantly attracted to him. You hear about this, you don't think it's ever going to happen to you, but I felt he was the man for me. It was like a pheromonal, I don't know, I was drawn to him.
And how long did that conversation last?
Lunch went for about an hour or so, but very quickly he turned me upside down. It's terrible to say now, but he said, we could go to lunch, or I've just had a haircut and I'm kind of covered in hair, so I'm going to go back to a hotel room and have a shower. Do you want to come?
What did you say, Kay?
I just thought, oh my God, he's so audacious. But he picked up his jacket and went to leave, and he said, you can either come with me now, or, you know, I might be back in a couple of months. And I could feel the eyes on all of the women, on me. It was like time stood still and there was silence and there was this great void, and I was compelled to answer, and I just picked up my handbag and followed him.
So you got a room. What did he tell you afterwards about himself?
Well, when we were in that room, he actually out of the blue started crying. I knew everything wasn't right, but he unsettled me right from the word go. But it was so powerful what was happening to me. And then when he cried, it brought out all of my nurturing and maternal, I cared for him. I wanted to know what was going on.
Why was he crying?
I don't know. I could only wonder at his hurt. And I had to leave. And so I never... So then it was the next stage, which was the next phone call. So there was always this state of suspended suspense.
Then he told you he'd been in jail. What happened then when he put that in front of you, Kay?
Normal girls would have run a mile. But you've got to understand, if you put this in context of Sydney, almost half the glitterati in Sydney have been inside for one thing or another, if it's cocaine or if it's white-collar crime. You know, there are so many celebs or judges or magistrates or politicians who've actually spent time inside. And so I thought, I'm going to take this in my stride. I'm not going to overreact. And I tried to get the information from him. He was really cagey about it. So I just presumed it was a bit of white-collar crime. Not that I'm kind of belittling it, but at the time, I tried not to place too much emphasis on it.
How soon was he sending you messages after that?
Straight away, bombarded. Every 10 minutes.
While you're at work?
Messages all the time. In my handbag, my phone was just buzzing when I was at home. And before too long, he actually started calling the home number, and I had no idea how he got that.
Do you know now how he got that phone number?
No, he did the most incredible things he was like a magician. It was like he was made of air.
I suppose that was kind of enthralling as well. It made him seem like quite a powerful person, I suppose, and that's attractive too, isn't it?
He is a powerful man, and he could shape things to his will. And he had ways of just invading your space and turning you upside down. And he made sure that he made my life very volatile very quickly.
Kay Schubach is with me today. She's written a book called Perfect Stranger. And it's the story of her relationship, if that's what you'd call it, with a very dangerous man called Simon. Tell me how you ended up lying with Simon in the path of a 747, Kay.
Well, he was bombarding me with texts and phone calls and saying, you've got to meet me now. And there was this incredible sense of excitement and urgency. And he grabbed my car keys and jumped in the car, and he hopped in the driver's seat and he whizzed off. I said, where are we going? And he said, shush, don't worry about, you know, minor details like that. He threw the CD out of my CD player out the window, and he popped in Carmen McRae.
See, right there, right there, he threw the CD, your CD out. Threw it out the window. That's worthless. Listen to this instead.
Yeah, I'm in control. I'm the man.
Right.
And we zoomed along and out towards the airport, and he pointed out a helicopter that was his friend's, and anyone's thinking, warning signs, but I was just in his thrall, and it was exciting, and I hadn't been excited for quite a long time.
Now, you knew at this point his name was Simon. You knew that he'd been in jail. Did you know his surname at this point?
No, but you've got to realise that he turned me upside down in a matter of days. So normally I just thought that I'd kind of met someone and, you know, Richard, I'd grab your name in a couple of days, you know. But he actually got in quickly and turned me upside down quickly, and he just didn't give me any information. He was too busy getting my information.
In all honesty, was that part of the appeal? The fact that he was on one level unknown and then on another level emotionally open, so he could, you know, he felt he could cry in front of you. The danger was part of the appeal?
I guess so. I mean, we twirled and whirled around the city, and with him I felt that I was just in the spotlight. You know, it was like a scene out of a movie where doors open for you and taxis appear and cocktails are delicious and everything just seemed to work like a charm.
At one point you sort of got in your head, I've actually just got to end this. This is terrible. Yeah. And you tried to ring up Simon and cut it off. What happened then when you rang him and said, I've got to end this?
Well, I really did know that I was in deep water. I was out of my depth, and very quickly, maybe within a week, but he had already infiltrated my life. And so I thought, I made the resolve, and I thought, I've got to go to a quiet place and I've got to call him and just tell him to leave me alone. I can't do this, which I did. I went to a cafe and I made the phone call, and he said, I'm too much for you, aren't I? And I said, yeah, you are. And he said, okay, that's fine. And, you know, I felt sad, but I was prepared to let it go and I felt strong. And then he said, I just want you to know that you no longer exist. If I see you in the street, you never were. Erase my number from your phone. You are nothing to me anymore. And I said, okay, fine. And I hung up and I was bawling my eyes out. He had such an effect. But I stuck with my resolve. And then he called me at work about half an hour later and said, meet me at the pub.
How hard was he pressuring you to leave Rob, your boyfriend who you're living with?
Constantly, constantly. He was constantly deriding Rob, telling me what a loser he was, that he was never going to give me a baby. Simon would give me a baby. Simon was the knight in shining armour. And he poisoned Rob in my eyes. He just told me over and over again what a loser he was and how he was using me.
So when you were ready to tell Rob what had been going on, how did you tell him?
I actually was painted into a corner. Simon called me on the home line and Rob was in the apartment, and Simon was wild. I didn't know if he'd been drinking or what was going on. He started abusing me and saying, you women, you're all the same. You treat men terribly. You've been with me and Rob is sitting in your house, ignorant of how awful you are. And he said, I'm not going to stop. I'm going to call him up and I'm going to tell him how what you women are really like. I hung up the phone. I was just, my heart was pounding and I wasn't ready to blow up my relationship. I needed time and to gather my thoughts. And this crazy guy had entered my life and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And I certainly wasn't ready to be dictated to by him. But I felt that that phone was not going to stop until he'd got his way. And so I put the phone down and I walked into the living room and I said, Rob, I've got to tell you something. I've been unfaithful.
And how did he react?
With stony silence. He looked at me with just absolute disgust and hate in his eyes. And he walked out.
You got a friend, well, he got a friend to mediate a breakup between the two of you. Your friend Ursula. How did that go, that mediation?
You know, when a relationship breaks up, you really don't want to bring other people into it because they're mutual friends and they don't deserve to get caught up in personal breakup or be called upon to take sides. And so I tried not to do that, which in retrospect added to my isolation. Ursula was an emotional counsellor and we'd kind of worked together and we'd worked. I had spoken to her about my frustrations of not being able to have a baby with Rob because Rob wasn't ready. So she knew that I had a hollow inside of me that he wasn't filling and that had been building for quite a few years. And so I thought that she would not necessarily be on my side, but I thought that she'd be objective. And so we met in a neutral place, and Rob and I were sitting there, and we weren't really talking to each other at that point. And Ursula walked in, and straight away she was quite combative, and she took sides, and she pretty much said, "Kay, you've been the person who has created the discord here. You're in the wrong." She said, "Obviously, you only value the superficial things in life. You love the thrill of the chase. And Rob values loyalty and steadfastness."
God,
and
but you really respected her, didn't you? And what was it like for you to hear having this being said to you like that by a person whose opinion you really value?
It's hard being judged at the best of times, but to be judged and found wanting as well. And then she gave me my marching orders. She told me I was despicable because I had fed Simon information about Rob that Simon had used against Rob. She said I was a despicable person and that I should move out of the apartment post-haste, and virtually gave me an exclusion zone that I shouldn't socialise or work anywhere near Rob.
And so that was it. Simon had you all to himself. And then, of course, he started to chip away at your confidence. How did he talk about you to his friends?
He actually had his friend on speakerphone and we were at a restaurant. And he said, "You haven't met Kay yet. She's an old boiler, but you'll like her." And my heart dropped. People turned around and looked at me. And of course, it played into all of my insecurities. You know, I was turning 40. I was worried about my biological clock ticking. Every girl worries about the lines around her eyes. And, you know, it was the beginning of a very clever plan of his to undermine my self-esteem. So he just put me down whenever he could, a little snarky remark here or there that just hit hard. Really, you know, the knife was in and he twisted.
And did he follow up with a, "Hey, just joking, baby, get over it," that
oh,
kind
yeah,
of thing?
Oh, yeah, get over it. You know, you've got to toughen up if you're going to be with me.
Then incredibly, he suggested you should get some medication. What did he mean by that?
Well, first he prefaced that by saying, "You know, you're pretty stressed lately and I know I'm a real handful. You know, you're crying a lot and then you're angry with me. Go and see my doctor. He's amazing. He'll give you something that'll just like soothe all of that, all of those problems away."
When he made a doctor's appointment for you, he gave it in his name. And for the first time, incredibly, you had his surname, Lowe, Simon Lowe. What did a Google search turn up on Simon Lowe?
Well, this was actually a few years ago, and people didn't Google people back then. It was a really unusual thing to do, and he wasn't expecting me to do that, but I did. First, I spelled his name incorrectly, L-O-W, and then I realised it was L-O-W-E, and so I punched that in, and bingo, report after report. There were court cases, there were rape cases, there were assault charges. There were journalistic reports on what a low-down and despicable character he was. Reams and reams and reams of it.
Slimy, callous. These are words being used in the tabloid press about him. And he'd even dated celebrities too, hadn't he?
Yes, he had. He'd been out with Barbara Hershey. He had been out with some women I knew, the ex-Miss Victoria models, actresses. You know, it was all on his CV.
Any convictions for these charges?
He had been convicted and then it had been overturned. So the more I read, the more I found out that he'd been exonerated from all of the charges. So I gave him then an extra mile. Anyone else wouldn't have, but I really wanted to believe in him. And by that stage, I'd blown up a relationship to be with him. I'd already been isolated from some friends, from mutual friends, and you know, I was without a home by that stage, and Simon was kind of there. He was my last resort very quickly.
Did you confront him once you'd found out this about him?
With complete disbelief, I said, "Simon, like, I've just read all these reports about you." And he said, "Who told you to do that?" He really was quite gobsmacked.
"Who told you to do that?"
Yeah. I don't know what he was thinking, but he was really gobsmacked that I would have had the wherewithal to Google. And of course, I found out later on that, well, he discovered that women actually do Google people now. And so he changed his name later on. I found out years later he assaulted another woman and he changed his name to Simon Bonito Monteiro, which is Portuguese.
What does that mean? Yes, what does that mean in Portuguese?
Portuguese for beautiful hunter.
I mean, that alone, never mind everything else. I mean, man, beautiful hunter, eh? Things got worse after this. You write about how you would go out with him and he'd meet friends of his who were ex-criminals known in jail, and you'd give him money and he'd then throw that into the street and jealous pique. And was there any kind and thoughtful behaviour to offset this?
Well, yeah, that was his MO, really, was that he oscillated so rapidly from being the most charming, the most exciting man. And I felt a million bucks when I was with him. When he was being wonderful, it was incredible. The world just opened up in front of you. We twirled around Sydney. He went into the Conservatorium of Music and we played piano and he sang. He had the most divine voice. And we swam in the swimming pool. He seemed to gain access. He had, you know, access all areas. He had a way about him that people were, they'd defer to him. He was a very powerful aura, but then he'd flip. And there was a menace and a brooding quality to him, and you just knew that there was this kind of danger building. But I blamed myself, and so quickly I tried to figure out what I had done wrong to change his mood and what could I do to stop to make him feel better.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio. On air, online, and on digital radio.
Today on Conversations, you're hearing Kay Schubach's story. Her book is called Perfect Stranger. Some years ago, Kay met her perfect stranger, a charismatic, good-looking, well-dressed man named Simon. Simon was exciting and fun. And then he began behaving erratically. So, Kay, Simon persuaded you that the sudden burst of anger were your fault.
My fault, yeah. Like I had looked at someone the wrong way. I'd glanced around the room, perhaps, and there was a fellow in there. He'd accused me of staring at him, of flirting. He was incredibly possessive and jealous very quickly. But I didn't see that so much as a danger sign. I saw that as proof of his love.
How were your friends at this time, and were you telling them what was going on?
At first, I spoke with my old girlfriends and I said, look, wow, this man's just swept me off my feet. My girlfriends were, oh, gosh, that's exciting, but be careful, go slowly, you know, use some caution and don't move so quickly. The Sydney friends got polarised very quickly because they were mutual friends with Rob.
Your ex.
And my ex. And so when we split up in such a volatile way, Simon made sure that our relationship exploded, you know, that there were yelling matches and that the neighbours were listening. And Simon loved a public arena, so whenever he could embarrass someone in public or take it out onto the street or into a cafe and shout and embarrass someone in public, he would. So it polarised my friends. They were absolutely disbelieving of what I had done.
This is textbook behaviour where the abusive male isolates the woman from her support network, her friends around her.
He controlled my phone. Every phone call, he could see my phone records, SMSs. He grabbed my phone all the time and went through it. He would hover over me if I took a phone call. So I became really afraid of my phone.
Kay, when did he become physically violent towards you?
There's different kinds of violence, and he became threatening, just in that menacing look on his face. Mm. We'd had a wonderful night. We'd been out to dinner. We had a cocktail afterwards, and we went back to the bedsit, and I went to undress to go to bed, and something snapped in him. I don't know what it was. A conversation that we'd have over dinner that he'd been brooding over. He started yelling at me, and I got nervous. I tried to put my clothes back on, and before I could, he had picked me up like a feather, opened the door, threw me out the door, slammed the door. So I was naked in the foyer of the apartment block. I quickly covered myself up as best I could with my hands and crouched against the door. A fellow came in the front door who I didn't know, and he said, oh, my God, are you all right? Simon was listening. He flung open the door, screamed at the guy, picked me up again, pulled me inside, slammed the door like he was my white knight, my saviour.
And then one night after you got an apartment together in Point Piper, You know, he hit you. He hit you several times. Did you try and hit back?
We were actually driving home one night, and I'd actually been to see some old friends and a girl who was dying of cancer, actually. I knew I wouldn't see her again, and Simon had been drinking. He got in my car, we got in the car, he drove, and he started screeching around the S-bends of Darling Point. I could barely get my seatbelt on. I was frightened just from his driving, and he started yelling at me that I was flirting, everything I'd done was wrong. He screeched the car to a stop in the middle of the night, in the middle of a bend on the road, on a hill, and got out of the car, slammed the door and left me in there. I tried to get into the driver's side to take the handbrake off and move the car. He had pulled the handbrake on so hard I couldn't disengage it. I looked up. He was looking straight at me. I could see his eyes down, you know, across 100 metres. He stormed back to the car and through the open window, all of a sudden, just everything went red and black, and he'd hit me with his fist inside his leather jacket. He screamed at me to get out of the driver's seat, so I scrambled back over. Then he hit me again, I think with his phone inside the jacket, and immediately this egg-sized lump on the side of my head. I didn't know if I was bleeding. I didn't know if something was broken. I was so frightened. And, yeah, I lashed out straight. You know, my instinct was just to just backhand him, which just, of course, inflamed the situation. And then I was just saying, take me to hospital, take me to the police. What are you doing? What have you done? I'd never been hit before.
The fact that his fist was inside his leather jacket suggests to me he didn't want to graze his knuckles and leave evidence.
Absolutely.
That it was him that had hit you.
He's certainly done this before.
That suggests a level of, I don't know, calculation, premeditation.
And practice.
The next day, what was his version of events after that had happened?
Of course it was all my fault. I'd been flirting in the pub. You know, I was with a girlfriend. That was just so manifestly wrong. I was with a girlfriend who was dying and a gay friend. You know,
that as a given. You weren't flirting, okay?
You're right, yeah. He said that I was drunk, that I had inflamed the situation. I should never have hit him first. And then he got into his stride about this story. And I could see, you could just hear it ticking away in his head. He completely then flipped it around to say that, he said, that's what I'll tell them. And I said, tell who? And he said, the police. I'm going to tell them that you hit me first, that you were drunk, that you're the aggressor. I've got scratches. I'll press assault charges on you.
Eventually, you went to the police in Rose Bay in Sydney, and he was already in there, wasn't he? He'd gotten there ahead of you and had been speaking to the police. What did you find out once you went into the police that he said to the police about you?
Well, I couldn't believe, like, he hated the police, and the police weren't that fond of him. I couldn't believe that he'd gone in there in the first instance. And so when I walked in, he had been talking very calmly and very charmingly to the police officer and saying that I was drunk and aggressive and that I was confused and upset and that I was going to come in and press assault charges on him. And obviously Simon was charming and sober and not at fault.
And you were distressed and injured and upset.
Yes.
And angry. Unfortunately for Simon, though, he was, as they say, known to the police,
yes,
wasn't he? So
yes.
Once they figured out that this Simon Lowe was Simon Lowe, what did the police offer you?
They were amazing, but you still can't believe that you're in that situation. You know, the fluorescent lights at the end of a long night when you've been hit and you've had to run away from your own apartment. And the only place that seems safe is a police station. And the police are wondering what on earth is going on. They do look at these things objectively until they've heard both sides of the story. And the police officer said to me, have you been drinking? I said, no, I haven't. And this is crazy. I can't believe I'm here. So they sat me down and for about 2 hours they took my statement. And Simon had stormed out and disappeared by that stage. And at the end of the evening, the police called a magistrate and they got an AVO put in place.
When they put it to you that you were the victim of a violent and abusive man and you were essentially, you know, in that old phrase, a battered woman, Did you recognise yourself as that woman?
You absolutely don't. It's like...
Why not?
Someone... It's like you're seeing yourself from the corner of the room. Well, you know, I'm an independent...
take charge, feminist. I've got this fantastic life. I'm not that
put-upon woman. That woman. I couldn't equate the two at all. And that I'd been violated, that I was the victim. None of those words I'd ever used connected with myself before. So it was absolutely, just didn't ring true.
Sadly, I'm sure that's a familiar thing to the police as well, isn't it? That women find it hard to accept that they are that woman. And you were that woman, weren't you?
No, but what I was incredibly bewildered by that stage. And my self-esteem had become incredibly eroded already, and I was confused. So I still didn't know if I had done something to cause this situation.
He was really cocky about court appearances, and the whole time you were with him, he had numerous court appearances. What would he say after he'd come out of court?
Well, first he'd go in and sack his legal counsel and represent himself in court. He was disdainful of absolutely everybody, including the magistrates, and he saw a court appearance as being an actor on a stage. He saw it as a public appearance for himself. And then when he got out, he'd come home and he'd strut up and down the apartment, and you could see the energy just flicking off him, and he'd say, "I slam them." He'd talk to one of the solicitors afterwards, a woman who he'd engaged on his behalf, and he said, "You may as well go home and commit suicide because you're obviously no good at your job. You can't even get an AVO up."
Did that work for him in any way in court?
You know, I hate to say that in a macabre kind of way it does. Any kind of drama in court... it seems to be better than the run-of-mill sad sack stories that go on. So there's a kind of a certain amount of titillation that he caused by just being so audacious. And it's a blokey world in there as well. He'd come out of court sometimes and lawyers or solicitors or barristers would actually pat him on the back and say, "Mate, amazing. You should have been a lawyer. Like, you really got the gift of the gab."
As you said, the police offered you an AVO. Did you accept it?
I didn't even know what an AVO was. It sounds so crazy now. I didn't know.
It's a court order, essentially, that will force the person named to keep his distance from you.
Yes, and so it was put in place immediately that night. What I didn't appreciate was that it protected me right from that moment. For me, it was just a really dangerous piece of paper that was going to inflame the situation.
And well, it would just enrage Simon to your
mind. Yeah, just enrage him. And I also had nowhere else to go. I had to go home. I had no car keys. I had kind of nowhere else to go. And he knew that there would have been pretty much a statement made or at least an AVO put in place, and I was terrified. All it meant was that I was more terrified.
I'm with Kay Schubach at the moment. She's written a book called Perfect Stranger. It's the true story of her terrifying and violent relationship with a man called Simon Lowe. So did you go home that night after the police had offered you an AVO, back to the apartment with Simon?
I did. It was partly because I'd thought of myself as a strong woman. I'd always been able to solve things in the past. I thought I'd be able to handle it. I thought I could negotiate. I thought I could calm him down. I thought I could explain.
So one part of you thinks I can handle this. In all honesty, is there another part of you, a small part, that thinks somehow, unjustifiably so, that I deserve this?
Not that I deserved it, but I thought that I was to blame. Not that I deserved it, but I thought I had done something wrong to cause him to get so upset. So I kept looking at what I had done and what I could do to change my behaviour to make it better.
What a trap.
I think women do this to a certain extent. We do like to... Normally, these are great traits in a woman, that you love someone, that you trust, that you show faith,
forgiveness,
steadfastness. Mm. In a normal relationship, these are wonderful qualities. But I wasn't able to see clearly that all of those things were completely irrelevant, and in fact, were going to do me a disservice.
When did you begin to realise he was trying to set you up as an unreliable court witness.
He constantly manipulated the version of everything that happened. So as things got more volatile and I kind of got more confused about what was happening to me and more bewildered about who I had become and more ashamed of the relationship and where I'd ended up and who I'd hurt to be there. Then he was constantly reinventing the story, constantly saying that, you know, you were wrong, you were the aggressor, I'm going to tell them that you did this, you did that. I just had to get away. One of the important things is to just try and get some silence, and so you can sit with yourself and try and figure out what's going on, because everything's so topsy-turvy and you're under the hammer all the time. So I would try to get to the beach and just have some silence and swim in the ocean and try and get this sordid story to wash off me. And my phone rang. He said, "Where are you?" And I thought about lying, but I just had a hunch I shouldn't. And I said, "I'm at Tamarama." And he hung up. And within, I swear, 2 minutes, he was there. There was a shadow over me on the beach and he was there. I don't know how he did it.
Well, he'd been following you and then he rang you to see if you were lying.
Yeah.
And you told the truth. And so there he was. And what did he say then once you saw him next to you?
He said, "See those guys over there?" And I looked over and they kind of waved. He said, "They're my mates." And he asked me to put some suntan lotion on him. And I said, "Oh, go away, put it on yourself." I was so furious with him by that stage. And he said, "Put it on." And so I'm like, whatever. So I rubbed some suntan lotion on his shoulder and he said, "See those guys over there?" And I go, "Yeah, what?" And he said, "They're taking photographs of us. I'm going to show those in court that, you know, how bad can it really be when we're lying on the beach together and you're lovingly rubbing suntan lotion onto me. And I've got the evidence." And any scratch he'd have, he'd try and get witnesses to say, "Can you see the scratch here? Obviously she's off her head. You know, obviously she's the assaulter in this case." He was constantly building a case against me.
The plan was for you to have his child and you became pregnant.
You know, I probably got pregnant to him the very first time we made love. And and at first the relationship was so wonderful. I felt that baby was conceived in love and that was all I wanted. And then, you know, it turned so quickly and so violently. I was almost in denial that I was pregnant, but then I got the tests and yes, of course I was. When he started to become violent, I thought that the baby would give me the strength to persevere against him. But I was so stressed, and then I got really bad morning sickness, and I was just, I couldn't cope. I was feeling awful. I was a physical wreck. I was a mental wreck really quickly, and I was sick. And he nearly killed me. I thought that I was going to die on the floor of my apartment with him smothering me. I screamed out and no one came. I realised that I had to use that fear and dig deeply inside myself and garner my resources. And I couldn't do that with a baby inside me. I was too terrified.
Eventually the police helped you escape the apartment and it was definitely time to go.
Eventually I already had a ticket to go down to Melbourne where I was from and where my really old girlfriends were. I was dreading going down because I knew I had to come clean with what had happened to me, that I'd been abused, I'd nearly been killed on the floor of my own apartment, and that I'd hurt a lot of people to get myself into that situation. So I flew down and my friends were there and they just hugged me and I just cried. And they literally grabbed me by the shoulders and shook me and they said, "You have to get yourself out of this situation and you can do it. Remember who you are."
After having escaped from the flat, you did a really smart thing, which was to go overseas for a long while. Mm. going to Laos, Southeast Asia. Did it take a while to recover from the flaming, catastrophic relationship you'd finally booked out on?
Oh, God, yes. It took a long time. I felt like I'd been to war. At first, I went into hiding. I went to a beach shack down in the south coast, and I wrote. I wrote it all down, day by day, forensic report of what had happened to me. And I'd felt so burned by what he'd done. Writing it down helped fling that off me. It helped. It was part of the healing process. But it helped just explain and put in perspective that it wasn't my fault. I had got myself into a situation stupidly. I hadn't seen the warning signs quickly enough. He'd manipulated me.
It's like your whole life had almost burnt down.
I lost everything. Mm. I had to move everything out of my apartment that I was paying a fortune for again, under police supervision in the space of 4 hours. I had a termination that broke my heart. On the way to the clinic to have that termination, I lost my job by telephone, over the phone, because I'd just become a wreck at work, and Simon had started to infiltrate the sacrosanct workspace. I had no friends, and, you know, it was awful.
You came back to Australia more than a year later. He'd given up on you, and he'd picked up with someone else. That must have been a chilling moment to look in the newspaper and see that he was up on a charge before the court. Tell me how that episode unfolded.
Okay. I actually got a phone call from the fellow I'd been out to lunch with the day that I met Simon, and he said, "Looks like Simon's up to his old tricks." And my heart just thumped in my chest at just the mention of his name. And I looked in the newspaper, and sure enough, he had assaulted another woman, well-to-do, self-contained, lovely woman from the eastern suburbs. So he certainly had his type. And she was pressing charges. I actually made contact with her before the media suppression came down on her name. And I said, "Look, I don't know if you want this in your life or not, but I've been through the same thing with him. And if I can testify against him in court, or if I can be of any help to you, please let me know." And she was very appreciative of that, but she had a great team behind her. She was she had a good legal team. She had friends and family who gave her a lot of support. So she said, "Look, no, I'm fine. Thanks, all the same." And so I watched, and then I saw that on the day of the trial, with full judge and jury, she actually pulled out. She dropped the charges. I spoke to her afterwards, and I said, "Why? You were so close." And she said, "I just didn't want to waste another minute of my life on that scumbag."
And then it happened again. Another woman.
So I got a phone call from the police, actually, and they asked me if I would testify in court. They knew that I'd been involved with Simon in the past, and that there was another assault, and that they wanted to get a watertight case against him, and would I testify? That was a real challenge to me. By that stage, it was quite a few years on. I thought hard about it. I said that I would by CCTV. I was too terrified to be in the courtroom with him, especially if he defended himself. So he'd just scream at you in the witness box.
And did you?
I didn't. They actually didn't ask me to in the end, so it was with enormous relief. But I went to the court case. I went to the sentencing. I went to the Downing Centre in the city, and I found the room with his name on the door. Opening that door was really challenging, and I walked in and looked at the people around me, and there were, you know, various court reporters and a couple of women, and I looked behind the glass, and the barristers and solicitors were there, and then I looked in front of me, and there was this very beautiful woman, beautifully made up, gorgeous accessories, and she had a death grip on her boyfriend's hand, and I realised this was the woman who had pressed the charges. And then I looked through, and the magistrate came in, and everyone stood up and sat down again, and then the back of the court door opened, and Simon walked in handcuffs, and he still had that ability to absolutely terrify me. And you could feel it in the room. He still charged the room.
Did he see you?
He looked right through the glass. I don't think he saw me. I was kind of sitting a little bit behind, and I ducked. I really ducked. I was still so frightened. I think he saw the woman who had charged him. And he saw another woman there, a court reporter. And when they took the handcuffs off him, he sat down and he pulled up his hand and he made a figure of a gun with his thumb and his forefinger, and he pointed it at the court reporter and pulled the trigger. And I just couldn't believe it. I don't think anyone else saw it.
He was found guilty in 2009 of non-consensual aggravated sexual assault causing grievous bodily harm, property damage and theft. He was charged, he appealed it, I think, and then the appeal was quashed and he was sent to jail for a long time. How did it feel once you'd known he was finally sent to jail?
Well, I was incredibly shaken when that sentence was handed down. I burst into tears. I spoke with one of the police officers, and by that stage I had been writing the book. And I said to the police officer, if the woman who pressed the charges wants to talk to me, I'd do anything to help her. I'd felt so guilty that I hadn't been brave enough to take him to court myself. So writing the book was actually a way to make up for that.
Kay, has this whole thing, this catastrophe with Simon, bent you out of shape? Is it going to be hard for you to trust someone else in future?
Yeah, I'd say I've got some scars, but I'm pretty guarded.
Okay, it's a really common thing with this situation where a woman suffers this kind of abuse. Some people, probably people hearing this will be thinking, oh, that silly woman, why didn't she run away much, much earlier? What do you want them to understand about this situation?
It is an erosion of your self-esteem, and it's hard for anyone else to see how frightened you are, and you've just lost perspective. You don't recognise yourself anymore. These guys are really good at blaming you for everything, telling you that you're wrong, you're stupid, you're old, fat, ugly, past your use-by date. There's a whole lot of shame going on. You don't want to talk to anyone about what has happened to you. You feel such a wreck and so embarrassed that you can't share your story with anyone. So it goes around and around in your head like a bee in a box. And you come to the wrong conclusions. You blame yourself and you feel pathetic and embarrassed and ashamed. I still, when I heard the story of what he had done to the woman who finally managed to get him sentenced, and I was listening in court to her story, I thought, that stupid woman, how did she let that happen to him? And then with like a thump, I realised that was my story and that exactly the same thing had happened to me. So even I had been through it, but I still couldn't believe that a woman could let that happen to herself.
Can you see what you would have done if this had been one of your friends?
But people are really reluctant to interfere in other people's relationships. You feel that that's sacred space, a person's relationship, and you don't want to intervene. With a girlfriend, I would still just say, look, it doesn't feel right to me, but you tell me when you need help. I'm here, I'm ready to catch you if you fall. But I still probably wouldn't step in unless I saw that she was really, really asking for help.
The police were reaching out to you, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. And I was too frightened to go to the police. Simon kept saying, why are you getting the dogs involved in our life? He painted them as the enemy. He had painted a picture of it was me and him against the world. So it was hard for me to side with who he had painted as the enemy, whereas in fact I was sleeping with the enemy.
Hang in there, Kay. It's been really amazing speaking to you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
OK, Kay Schubach's book is called Perfect Stranger. If after hearing this you think you might need some advice, there are many agencies that can offer support, but Lifeline's always a good place to start. Their number is 13 11 14. It's 13 11 14.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.